From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, our regular education quiz with Rachel Morello.
Then we look at how Wisconsin stacks up when it comes to women in the workforce.
The statistic we quote for the percentage of women on public company boards in Wisconsin is only 17.6%, which is really bleak.
We'll learn about the artistic challenge of making photographs from space appealing.
It's probably not very hard to make a nebula look otherworldly and awed, as opposed to, oh, look at that cool place I could almost touch.
And Milwaukee singer-songwriter Haywood Williams explains a specialized skill that he's acquired.
I pride myself on having optimistic-sounding songs with really sad lyrics.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. The upcoming holiday means there is a lot to prepare for, even if you're not making a turkey. For many people, there is a lot of catching up to do over the holiday weekend. You might be spending time with kids during their break from class, or maybe you'll sit next to a relative who's a teacher during your Thanksgiving meal.
Either way, lucky for you, WUWM's education reporter Rachel Morello joins us with a few ideas for things to chat about with the school-minded people in your life. She joins us every so often for a quiz on what's going on in education around Wisconsin. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Mitch. There's certainly plenty going on as we head into the holiday weekend. Let's see how many of these stories you'll be able to chat about with authority. Y'all ready for this?
Y'all ready for this?
You know it.
Okay, here we go. Wisconsin schools and districts have been waiting on something, and it came just in time for the holidays. Can you guess what that might be?
I do know this. It is report cards.
That's correct. The State Department of Public Instruction released annual report cards on Tuesday. Every district and every individual school gets one each year, and they designate accountability ratings for schools, along what's essentially a five-star scale, with one being the lowest and five being the highest. As a refresher, they grade schools on metrics like achievement on state tests, student attendance, student graduation rates, and this year the scores paint a brighter picture for Wisconsin. The majority of the state's students are performing at or above expectations. But there's a but, Mitch. State officials say they're not sure if those scores are an accurate reflection of what's happening in the classrooms.
And why is that?
Well, the DPI says it could be related to the way they calculate scores. Basically, there's been a change in the last few years in the way DPI calculates growth, which is the change in student performance over time. And the significant portion of higher scores this year could have been caused by what they're calling statistical volatility in those calculations. It's a little bit complicated, so if folks want more information, I've reported out a full story, and they can find that on our website.
Fantastic. So I'm one for one here. What is my second question?
Well, you can't get away from report cards just yet. I've got a second question about that.
Oh.
So there was a second key takeaway from the latest round of report cards, and it was actually news about something that didn't happen. Was it that A, no schools received 5 out of 5 stars, so no schools received the highest rating, B, no districts received failing marks, or C, no voucher schools received report cards this year?
I'm going to go with C.
Actually, every voucher school received a report card.
You know, I thought that we talked about that in the last one of these,
yep.
but so it's either A or B.
It's B, that no districts received failing marks this year. So this is actually great news for folks in Racine specifically. You might remember we talked a few weeks ago about how the Racine Unified School District was facing pressure of a potential state takeover. They'd received a failing report card last year, and if you remember that little thing called OSPP, the Opportunity Schools and Partnership Program,
right.
Basically any district that receives 2 failing marks in a row is subject to that program, which would create sort of a turnaround structure. But similar to what happened in Milwaukee Public Schools last year, Racine improved its score, so the district is no longer at risk of qualifying for that program.
I think I am at risk of a state takeover of my answers here. I'm 1 for 2, which I think is a failing grade.
Well, so far, probably. But you've got one more, and it's not about report cards this time.
All right.
So I'll give you one more before I let you leave for your holiday break.
Bring it on.
This week, a prominent group in Milwaukee brought a lawsuit to the state Supreme Court against a prominent figure on Wisconsin's education scene. Who did they bring the suit against? Was it A, State Superintendent Tony Evers, B, MPS Superintendent Darian Driver, or C, the Marquette Golden Eagles mascot?
As tempting as it is to say C, I'm going to say A.
A, the State Superintendent Tony Evers is correct. Lawyers at the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, otherwise known as WILL, are suing the state superintendent, arguing that under his leadership, the Department of Public Instruction has been writing rules for school policy without running them through the process laid out in state law. Wisconsin has this new thing called the RAINS Act, and it's been in place since this summer, and basically it says state agencies have to submit rule proposals to the governor before they draft anything permanent. Although the legislature is ultimately the one passing laws related to schools, they leave a lot of the specific language up to the DPI and the superintendent. And WILL's general counsel, Rick Essenberg, says this is an issue of transparency, authority, and accountability.
The legislature is trying to set up a structure that would apply to all administrative agencies that would provide for greater accountability. And you have to keep in mind that this would apply no matter who holds these positions. So if there's a Democrat who is elected governor in 2018, well, that person would be the one who gets to review administrative agency rules under this act.
So that was Rick Essenberg of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty.
Yep. And it's interesting that he brought up the concept of a Democrat being elected governor here, Mitch. Some people are saying they find this lawsuit to be politically motivated. WILL is often described as a conservative group. And Superintendent Evers, even though he's nonpartisan in his role as schools chief, is running as a Democrat for the seat as governor in 2018.
So interesting timing for the lawsuit regardless.
Yes, definitely. Well, you got 2 for 3.
Yes.
You are at or above expectations.
Thank you very much.
Nice job, Mitch.
Lake Effect's Rachel Morello is WUWM's education reporter. She joins us every couple of weeks for an education quiz that we call Passing Notes. You can read and hear more of her coverage and submit ideas for future stories at WUWM.com/education.
The state of women in the Wisconsin workplace, that's the subject of a piece in the current Milwaukee Magazine and an interview coming up after a break. Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyne.
And I'm Bonnie North. With daily allegations of sexual misconduct being made against men in powerful positions, there's also a growing conversation about how these men have affected women in the workforce. Women have described environments where powerful men were shielded from their accusers, while victims were often shamed and bullied into leaving their jobs.
This month's Milwaukee Magazine looked at how men and women are paid, promoted, and hired in Wisconsin workplaces. Carol Nixon, editor-in-chief of the magazine, joined writer Anna Miller and Lake Effect's Joy Powers in the studio, and Miller started by talking about the dynamic that exists in Wisconsin.
Part of it is just choices themselves, like what careers women choose to go into. Another reason is childcare. Some women have to leave work after a certain amount of time. There's something called the mother tax in some literature, where women who have children are paid less because companies think that they're not going to be a stable employee. They're just going to leave after a certain amount of time to have more kids. So there's the choices, there's that. But then when you factor all that in, there's still some of it that comes from outright discrimination in terms of hiring processes.
I mean, you just mentioned that women will leave work because of childcare. But in your piece, you actually said that really only accounts for 10%.
Yeah, that's true, but that's their perception of it, that that's what will happen. That's not entirely true, but it's the misconception that some people have in businesses, especially in the corporate area.
What are the kinds of misperceptions that continue looking at motherhood, but also being a woman in general, I guess?
For motherhood, it's that they won't be as invested in their work because their mothers. And that's supposed to be a full-time job, I guess, in some stereotypes that still exist. And being a woman in general, studies show that people see women as being more emotional, more inclined to do things for other people, like bring in cookies to the office or something like that, to be better at the people work than, say, the math science route.
One of the things brought up in the piece was the Goldilocks syndrome. Mm-hmm. Can you unpack that?
It's that if you're outspoken as a female, then you're seen as being aggressive and mean. But if you're too nice, then people will just walk over you, I guess.
And how does that play out when we're talking about jobs and mm-hmm. whether or not people are getting jobs?
Yeah, that all factors into the implicit bias part of this, the perception of women and when they're being hired. It's like they have to act a certain way to be thought of as being hired and then also to be considered for promotions. They have to walk a fine line there that their male counterparts might not necessarily have to walk.
You list companies in Wisconsin whose board of directors are at least 1/4 women, which seems a pretty low bar. Mm-hmm. The best is Alliant Energy at really just 50%.
Yeah.
So that's the one that's doing it the best just has 50% women mm-hmm. in a state which is more than 50% women.
Yeah.
The others, most of them fall precipitously after that, the majority coming in at under 30%. When you've talked to people about this piece, as I'm sure you have, mm-hmm. have people been surprised by this? Do they know that boardrooms are this disparate?
People that I've talked to have not. Yeah, even people in my – I work another full-time job when I've talked about this. They were surprised because I work in – healthcare and writing in my company is pretty equitable. Seeing this across the board as a conglomerate, when a lot of people just work in their own micro spaces, they don't see the big picture every day. Seeing the big picture was pretty surprising for at least my friends and my coworkers.
Overall, I would add that the statistic we quote for the percentage of women on public company boards in Wisconsin is only 17.6%, which is really bleak.
Mm-hmm. It's surprising. I was surprised to see that it was less than 20%. Again, in an area where women are 50%
yeah,
of the people.
Exactly, as they are in most places, yes.
And some of that, as I talk about in the article, it comes from that insular network of other people who are on the board are male and have been there for a long time. So they take on the people they know, who they think will be good for the job, a.k.a. people in their network, other men working in that same field.
Well, and that's something that you bring up that you call the old boys club. And I think we all hear this term quite a lot, but we rarely define it. Mm-hmm. How do you define it?
It comes back to that network thing. It's a large percentage of the way people get jobs isn't just applying online or submitting their resume. It's through people they know. And people that maybe older men know from working in a business that was previously dominated by men, they would be used to having men in those roles and having their network would be mostly male. So seeing women try to get into that network is harder because it's hard to break from what you know.
I think one interesting thing that came out in the article, one of the women who Anna interviewed is Emily Phillips, and mm-hmm. She talks about the old boys club to some degree and how when she was entering the business world, she made the decision to learn to play golf because, you know, it didn't take too much to observe that that's where relationships were mm-hmm. forged and people got ahead. And I think that, you know, that's very common. Certainly that's not unique to mm-hmm. Milwaukee. I mean, I think it happens everywhere. But I think in a community this size, relationships tend to go back further. So in general, I think people tend to gravitate towards people they've known since school and et cetera. And I think something that goes along with that is a sort of insidious sexism, because if you're a man and your best friend has another guy friend that they want you to hire or that they put up for the job, it just makes sense that these things continue on and on and mm-hmm. on.
I mean, Carol, you are really the head of Milwaukee Magazine, and you are also an outsider to Wisconsin. Have you found yourself in some ways coming up against this old boys club mentality?
Well, you know, I have a couple different types of observations. One of the things that inspired this article was about a year ago, I was invited to a meeting of Professional Dimensions. And at that meeting, it was, I believe, an anniversary meeting, and we were given topics of discussion at each table. And at my table, we were talking about how things have changed for women over the course of the years. And so there were, you know, I'm proudly middle-aged, but there were older women and younger women at that table. And they were talking about how, you know, as recently as the 80s into the 90s, but particularly the 80s, a female lawyer was saying that her firm would have meetings at men's clubs like the university club or other clubs that excluded women, and she would just not be able to go. They wouldn't accommodate her, you know, she just wasn't able to go. Another example a woman gave was of a restaurant in town that catered to business lunches, and they had a counter space and then a table and tables, and women were not allowed to sit at the counter because that was for men who had important things they needed to get back to. And so they had a reason for having to sit and get speedy service at the counter. So that type of thing happening as recently as the 80s came as a surprise to me as an out-of-towner, and again was one of the reasons why we did this article.
I was about to say, are these experiences that squared with your own?
I think that perhaps the workforce in New York was a little bit more advanced in those ways at that time. Although I do remember one of my first jobs when I was still in school part-time. I worked as a receptionist at the Academy for Educational Development, and it was across the street from the University Club in New York, and there were areas there that the female executives at the Academy did not have access to, which is hard to believe.
This can even square with my personal experience, even though I'm younger. A friend of mine, his brother is a lawyer, and in a conversation with him, he runs a firm in the city. He said he would never hire a woman because they would just they couldn't handle the job and raising kids at the same time. He said that that's not something a woman should do, and he hasn't hired a woman. So,
which is of course illegal. But speaking of that being, of course, illegal, something that you mentioned inside of your article was the Equal Payment Enforcement and Transparency Acts. Mm-hmm. What were they?
They were acts put in place by the Wisconsin government to make sure that people would be held accountable if they weren't like outright discriminating in their pay.
What happened to them?
They were repealed by Scott Walker.
And what was the rationale at the time? Because I've been trying to kind of figure that out, but it seems as though really all these acts did was give teeth to already existing legislation that makes discrimination illegal.
I really can't tell you.
Another interesting thing, this article, we started working on it prior to all of the sexual harassment cases that have come up in the news. And our article doesn't talk at great length about sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. But I think that all of these women coming out with stories of sexual harassment just goes to show things are far from equal for women in ways that, you know, I think many of us thought we'd resolved these issues already, but we have not.
Yeah, and I'm sure these tales of sexual harassment aren't just the ones in the entertainment industry are very public because people are aware of these figures, they care about them, but it's not just in the entertainment industry, it's in anyone you can think of.
It's in everything. I mean, it, of course, happened with NPR.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mike Oreskes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There was a quote that stuck out to me inside of the piece. Executives are starting to have conversations about why they need women at the top. But honestly, this is something that I've heard my entire life, mm-hmm. I would say your entire life, certainly. And I would guess, honestly, Carol, your entire mm-hmm. life. This has mm-hmm. been something that's been floating around for decades since mm-hmm. women got the right to vote. What makes people hopeful now?
I would say that change is always, unfortunately, slow, and that whoever has power is typically slow to relinquish that power. But I think that one reason to be hopeful is just the critical mass. And I do think that we're at a point with so many women, professional women in the workforce, with women being better educated than they ever have been before in history, that our voices will be heard. I mean, with so many of us, it's just inevitable. It might be slow, but I think progress is inevitable.
And I think it helps for younger girls or women entering the workforce as more and more women get to those positions to see people in those positions who are like them and to be able to aspire to those roles and have those mentors who are like them.
Anna Miller is a Milwaukee-based writer, and Carol Nixon is editor-in-chief of Milwaukee Magazine. They spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers.
Coming up next, astronomy contributor Jean Creighton joins us to talk about color in space, what we can perceive and what we can't. That's right here on Lake Effect after this short break.
This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Every month, Jean Creighton comes down to the studio from her usual haunt in the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee to tell us stories about the cosmos.
And today she's in a festive mood. Hello, Jean. Are you ready for Thanksgiving?
I'm always ready for Thanksgiving.
Me too.
I just think of all of that warm, lovely food. It's the colors of the table that make me very excited, as well as the tastes, of course. But the first thing you do is you see the food.
Yeah.
And then you smell it. And then of course, you taste it. And so this is a very labored way of me getting into what we're talking about, because it's how we see things, how we perceive things, and whether they're appealing to us or not. And I know you have a program going on right now at the planetarium that's about the colors of the universe. So my understanding of the universe is that there really aren't colors the way we understand them, because they're in a range of the spectrum that we can't perceive.
That is true to a large extent, that most of the light that's out there is invisible to our eyes. So to say that they have a color would be a falsehood, right? Of course, there are things that do make light in the part of the spectrum that we see. So if you look, say, at Jupiter, for example, it will have colors in its atmosphere. If you look online at some of the beautiful videos that they produce, you can be sure that those colors are enhanced. But there is color. There's color on Jupiter. There's color on Neptune. But if, let's say, you go and look at those beautiful nebulae.
Which I love to
which are heartwarming. And, I mean, I'm thinking the cranberries. I was thinking of that gorgeous red and cranberries. I like red, as you know. You see these beautiful nebulae with all these colors. And in your heart, you think, oh, just imagine looking through my spacecraft at that. Well, you wouldn't see that. Most of the gas, if you were close enough, really close to it, it is probably so diffuse, they wouldn't make any light enough, certainly not enough light for our eyes to capture. Remember, what we're seeing is light that comes from literally hundreds of light years of material. And also, these things emit lights in different wavelengths in ways that if I wanted to know, okay, where are the hot spots on this nebula, or where is it densest? I have different filters that will give me that information. So often that filter, it could have been black and white. It is black and white in the original. If you look at Hubble telescope pictures, they're black and white. But if you enhance, if you put a color to it, then you can look at multiple images simultaneously and you can get a better feel for the whole thing.
It makes it more three-dimensional, I would
think. It certainly does.
And how are those colors assigned?
Well, in some cases, they're assigned because of tradition. So let's say, this particular filter is closest to the blue in the spectrum, so we'll call this blue. But what do you do with things that just don't have any color because they're in ultraviolet? Well, depending on what your needs and wants are, if you're really looking for the hot spots, you'll probably want to give a color that would suggest hot, like, say, a bright yellow or something. In some cases, though, these things are a matter of aesthetic pleasure. So I've been reading a fascinating book that is looking at Hubble Space Telescope images from an artistic point of view and how some of the color scheme and the focus and where they decide to frame the picture, it's been influenced by 19th century adventure paintings from the West, because that's assumed to be a frontier, right? So you want it to be awesome, but you also want it to be a little familiar. It's probably not very hard to make a nebula look otherworldly and odd, as opposed to, oh, look at that cool place that I could almost touch.
I could almost go there.
I could almost go there.
So do scientists who are making these aesthetic decisions, do they work with artists, or do they have art history people who are saying, you know, there was this kind of painting in the 1840s that did this? I mean, how is that happening?
Well, I think that now we kind of have two kinds of images. So we really have the images that were intended for scientists, and they might decide that I don't want any color, I want very specific colors that match a previous experiment or something else. And then I think there are people whose background is art history and they're artists themselves who get to figure out, how can I put these multiple images together so that the whole is as gorgeous as I can make it.
Yeah, I was going to say, I understand scientists are using this as tools of work, but, you know, scientists get to have pretty things too, you know.
Of course, of course. And in fact, I saw, I think it's NGC 3231, so it's a planetary nebula, and I'm used to seeing it with the colors that very much resemble Yellowstone, that particular color scheme. And in this book, they show the same object in a color scheme that they considered for the Hubble Heritage Site. Electric pinks. It's all, you know, versions of bright pinks, deeper pinks, really quite, what's the term?
Vibrant?
Yeah, vibrant and a little extreme, I would say, a little extreme. And yet, the features of the nebula are still perfectly maintained. It's just a different color scheme. So it reminds you that you don't really change the characteristics of it. You just change the look of it, the color of it. And I think they decided to go with something, again, that spoke to the more natural, the more familiar, than something that was so otherworldly and,
right,
and jarring. I mean, the word is jarring.
Yeah, electric
really.
Pink,
yeah.
Jarring.
Yeah.
Electric pink.
Yeah.
Now, if we were to put filters over our eyes that allowed us to see into the infrared or into the ultraviolet, what kinds of things would we see? Would we see color at that point, or would we not recognize what we're seeing as what we think of as color?
I think we would get some kind of signal. My guess is that if we had such a filter, I don't know that we would see color. I actually am not sure. What I do know is that your camera would attach some kind of color to it, or it would be black and white, I guess. But I'm thinking of when I looked at Northern Lights with night goggles, there was almost a bluish green, yellowish green, blue color, but that came probably from the aurora themselves. So I'm assuming if it had color, I would see it. The infrared wouldn't add any color. I would just maybe see a little brighter signal.
Right. I'm just wondering if we had the capability of being able to see into the infrared, if we would all of a sudden, you know.
We probably would have different colors. It would be like something we can't describe because we can't do.
Right.
I know that some people, I've read that people can see another kind of purple. There are people who can see a little beyond what most people can. And I believe butterflies identify a fourth color of the basic colors. So, and how
right,
we
more
know
cones
this, I couldn't tell
more
you.
Rods
yeah,
and all
yeah.
of that sort of
but,
stuff. Yeah.
But I think I'm thinking of pictures of dogs. So you'll see a picture of a doggy, and then there's an infrared picture, and what it brings out is all the warm spots of the dog. So the eyeballs of the dog are going to be the hottest thing on his face. If you look at people in infrared, you know, their hands are going to be warm, their heads are going to be warm, a lot of heat escapes from our heads. So, again, an infrared image is going to give you different information. It's going to tell you where your hot spots are.
Which is pretty cool.
Which I think is appropriate for Thanksgiving. We should find our hot spots.
We should find our hot spots, you know, right on the table, surrounded by family and friends.
Yeah.
Well, Jean, have a wonderful day tomorrow. I hope you eat lots and lots of all of the wonderful foods that you love, and we will talk next month.
Thank you so much.
Lake Effect Astronomy contributor Jean Creighton is also the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium located on the campus of UW-Milwaukee. You can find out about their shows from a link at WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break, and then Milwaukee singer-songwriter Hayward Williams joins us for some conversation and some tunes. Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Rain in sad waves, we prayed for encores, saw the band could barely hold them. Soon they vanished with no tail lights. Could they save us from our hometown? How we begged them, how we broke down.
More of Lake Effect now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Milwaukee singer-songwriter Hayward Williams finished writing and recording his new album last October. A lot has happened, both in the world and in the life of Hayward Williams in the last 13 months. But as we'll hear, that doesn't make the songs on Pretenders any less relevant.
The album roars to life on Saturday night with a CD release show at Anodyne Coffee in Walker's Point. Ahead of the show, Hayward Williams came by and offered some unplugged versions of some of the songs on the new album, including this one called In the Fire.
In the lowlands, we packed our last show. It was all right. We drove through the night and left you stranded in the morning fog. I was ready to stand beside you, no answers, no revenue. All the shadows that hide inside you have no master, a code to keep to. From the deep end, we all could feel them chained to ankles of long lost friends. In the fire, we fought together for the glory of sons and daughters. I know I'm not alone. I know I'm not alone. I know I'm not alone. I know. I know. I know. I know I'm not alone now. In the fire, we fought together for the glory, sons and daughters.
Hayward Williams, hey. In the Fire, in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. Thanks a lot.
It was my pleasure.
Great to see you again.
It's good to be back.
What's that song about?
It's kind of extremely autobiographical of the arc of my career, I guess. It kind of starts, I saw Gillian Welsh and David Rawlings play at the Barrymore back in like 2003 or 4.
That's in Madison.
That's in Madison, right. And it was so good. And I had been writing and recording at that time, but then I saw them play and I was like, oh, you need to be trying harder and reaching further and trying to like actually say something. And so once I figured that out, I, you know, started touring more and playing more, and the song kind of dips in a little about that, and everything comes together, and then everything falls apart, and then you kind of at least figure yourself out, if not what you're doing. So that's kind of what the song's about.
And the idea of the fire,
yeah,
is it could be anything.
Well, yeah. Well, I guess I got into the deep end of things a lot quicker than I thought I would, and so it's kind of a good way to figure out what you're made of and what you need to do, and it was exciting, but it also showed me I had a lot to work on, and so it's transformative for sure.
We were talking in early November, and the new album is just about to come out.
Yeah.
Pretenders.
Right. It comes out on November 25th.
And the tracks you recorded in October, but October of last year.
Yeah. That's the way this beast works, yeah.
And I was thinking about, I mean, that the trick for a songwriter, the world is a different place in a lot of ways in the year between the time you finish recording something and the time it might come out.
Yeah. It's, most of my songwriting, when it's not utterly autobiographical, is reactionary to what's going on. And so, you write songs about what's happening in the world, and then all of a sudden you record them, and then are they still going to be relevant in a year and a half? And, I have some more political kind of tunes than I normally have, and I wrote them,
I think before, a lot of people do.
Before the election, and then I was like, are these still going to be relevant? And sadly, in a lot of ways, they still are. And so it's not something to be excited about. but here we are.
But right, it raises the question whether the shelf life of political songs is shorter than it once was, or is that something that's, you never have to worry about the shelf life of a political song?
I don't know. It still has to be a good song, I guess. so if it's a good song, then whether or not it's political, is not entirely important right away.
Was there a spark that set into motion the creation of this album?
Yeah, I had a daughter 2 years ago, and I had time on my hands in the sense that I was kind of always around taking care of her. And I didn't want my career, as it were, to kind of slowly dissipate away from me. So I just kept on writing. And the difference between a lot of these songs and previous songs is I would play so many shows and kind of vet them in front of audiences and kind of change them depending on how they work or how they didn't work. And whereas the majority of these songs are fresh in the sense that they were never put through that ringer or that process. And so it's really kind of a leap of faith in a lot of ways to see if I can trust my own editor. Yeah.
Were you playing for your daughter anyway?
Yeah, she's heard this record way too many times. I think she's even more over it than I am in a lot of ways.
At the ripe old age of two.
Yeah, right. No, she knows the lyrics to a lot of songs. And so I think in any case, if she gets into them, then there has to be something deep within them that rings. So hopefully, maybe she's the canary for me to use from now on.
Well, I want to ask you more about it, but I feel like at this point we should hear more from it. I feel like you're in a very optimistic key.
It seems that way, doesn't it? this is a song off the record called Because of You. And, yeah. No more explanation. Lost in Atlanta. The sea never breezed through in a day. Tied up in London, afraid I'll never make it back to Spain. You say that it's over and that we never made it to the gate. It's too late, it's too late. Home for the long run.
need you like I want another drag. Watching the sideshow, now they're all out waving a flag. You say that we're dying, losing ourselves in the fight. Not tonight, not tonight. Crying, this whole world is lost on you. And no one can tell you what to do. Well, come up beside me and take you down the end of Mercy Street. And all of them running, and there's a lot of strange people to meet. You say they were nothing, and that nothing's coming down the line. I feel fine, I feel fine. Crying, this whole world is lost on you. No one can tell you what to do. I don't understand anything because of you, or because you, or because of you, or because of you.
Hayward Williams, Because of You, in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
And maybe my initial impression of the optimism of that song was tempered.
I pride myself on having optimistic sounding songs with really sad lyrics.
Well, and there's that little guitar lick in there that my music theory is. is remedial, but it sounds like you go into a minor key for just a brief moment in that every verse.
Yeah.
Which I think tempers the sound of it.
It's a great way to. It's always good to throw a curveball in there.
you are in here solo with your guitar, but obviously the new album has a much larger cast of characters.
Yeah, it's I've been doing this long enough to have bumped into some really incredible musicians, many of whom are in Wisconsin. A great friend of mine named Corey Matthew Hart from Madison played guitar and sang, and he's an amazing vocalist. And also had a friend from Chicago, Charlie Koltok, playing drums, who I've used on a couple of records, and he's amazing. And then I had a friend of mine from Providence, Rhode Island, fly out Jeremy Moses Curtis to play bass, and he's a bad, bad man. and a friend of his out in Boston named Brooks Milgate played B3 Hammond, and so it's...
He did that, I remember seeing that, did he do that remotely?
He did it remote, we sent him the tracks, and he's one of those people that just knows what to do, and so... I was fully prepared to not have any notes for him, and I'm glad that I did not prepare, because it was fantastic. I told him to basically, do what the guy in Memphis and Al Green's band would do, and I think he delivered in spades. So.
You know, we're having this conversation, and I'm thinking back to three interviews I've had in recent months with female singer-songwriters in which the idea of motherhood has come up. And it was a surprise to me. I almost didn't notice that it was happening in all of them, and they all had it was in a different place for each of them. Obviously, fatherhood did not come up with them because they were women.
True.
But I mean, let me ask you, because in the meantime, since the album was recorded, you've actually increased the number of children at home by 100%.
100%.
Is having a small child at home a well? I would wonder if it's is it inhibiting from a creative perspective, or does it give you more creativity and yet less energy with which to create?
It gives all those things and takes away from all of those things at the same time. It's you kind of just have to find the moments where things are working and hopefully be productive. Sometimes the lack of sleep is a great way to open doors in your mind that are normally closed. But then also you become more productive with the free time that you do have available to you. But on just a spiritual level, it just kind of makes working and being creative easier in the sense that it's, you know, all the cliches, you know, like little miracles every day. It's incredible.
What about the cliche about the seeing the world through fresh eyes?
Oh, God. you know, it sounds terrible, but like I feel like with the first kid, that's the way it goes. And then the second kid, you know, you're already taking less pictures of them and stuff. It's terrible. But it's
you're photoshopping the younger one onto the older pictures, right?
They're different people and different, and you're different, and the experiences are always different, and so there's no way to kind of put your finger on any of it. It's all amazing, and it's all exhausting, you know, and so there's no way that it can't inform how you live your day to day or and how you get your work done. But I would not change it one single moment.
Does it change the dynamic for your ability to go out and tour?
Absolutely. And in a lot of ways, that's great because I did my fair share of it for a long time, and I was kind of really looking for an ironclad excuse not to go out as much, and now I have it. And I've never been much of a guy to hang out after shows and party and chew the fat, and so being able to say, well, I have to go home, regardless of whether or not that's true, people, you know, usually give me plenty of leeway on that.
It's a beautiful nice. Built-in excuse.
Oh, it's fantastic. Yeah.
Got to get the babysitter home.
Yeah, yeah. It works.
It's not, I guess, in the grand scheme of things, a year is not all that long between the time that a record starts to come together and the time that the actual physical thing, if there are physical things anymore, comes out. But at the same time, especially given what you were saying before about not having test marketed a lot of the music on this, do you look at the release of this with more apprehension than previous work that you've done? Maybe apprehension's the wrong word.
Apprehension is a good word. I think I did initially. Kind of after the recording, you kind of have this afterglow where you're really excited about it. And then, you know, a month or two settles in and then you start reanalyzing all the songs and kind of taking another look at it. And it's easy to get really critical and doubtful in yourself and what you've done. But I think just kind of the new headspace I'm in with being a dad and being driven in a different way than I used to be, I've allowed myself to not worry about that as much. And I think it's only for the best because I spent so much time worrying about all that stuff. And not to say that what I produced in that time wasn't with merit, but I think now I'm going to places that I wouldn't necessarily go to, and I'm excited about that. And I think I'm still within the realm of what I've created as an artist, but I definitely have touched on new things that I probably wouldn't have done before.
At the very least, you can start playing gigs at playgrounds.
Oh, that's, you know, if that's what it comes to, I think I'll be all right with that.
I think we're all right with whatever you want to play for us. But before then, Hayward Williams, congratulations both on the new album and the new edition. And thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me again.
Like a wire strung out of sight, like a fire on a lonely night, I was looking for you. I was looking for you. All the running, all the destiny, and took my hope and took the breath from me. I was looking for you. I was looking for you. It's only love, only love that I found. All the kindness that I couldn't take, all the bonds that I tried to break. I was looking for you. I was looking for you. Tell me, mama, am I losing now? On this heart that's filled with doubt, I was looking to you. I was looking to you. It was only love, only love. Keep it together, keep it together now, honey. Oh, keep it together, you just be high.
Hayward Williams' new album is called Pretenders. He'll play a CD release show this Saturday evening at Anodyne Coffee in Walker's Point. Our in-studio session was engineered by the ever-wonderful Jason Reavy. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again on Thanksgiving at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Fresh air comes your way next. It is 11 o'clock.
I come running to you. It's only love, only love.